But the only banter I have is Drew and I went apple picking on Sunday. And we went to the Grafton one. And so, like, on our way back, we stopped at My Just Desserts for lunch and pie. And
Because you
then
have to.
we were driving out of town, but, like, I went through, like, their main street instead of, like, the normal way where you just turn back down, get on that side
Yeah.
road,
The
and go
get out and
back.
dodge quickly
Yeah.
one.
And we drove past, and I saw something that had like a skeleton or something on the sign or something like that, and like a bunch of goth girls were coming out of it. And I was like, wait a minute, did you see that?
Wait a minute, I want to be a goth
And it
girl.
was called like Soul Asylum, is what it was called, in Alton, Illinois, which is supposed to be like the most haunted city in the United States or something like that.
Keep claiming that, and I'm just not seeing it.
I know. But anyway, so we went in there, and it was like an old hotel that this guy, he was telling us all about it. His name was, I want to look it up so I get it right, because he was really nice. I think his name was Dave. But anyway, so he was really nice, and he was telling us how, like, he and his wife don't have any kids, so, like, throughout their life together, they've just been, like, collecting oddities and, like, weird stuff and whatever. And I feel like it was just, like, a mini, like, Zach Bagans museum, because he had, like, dirt from, like, John Wayne Gacy's crawl space, and, like, he had a serial killer
Yeah.
section and, like, a torture section and, like, all this other
Oh, this
stuff.
sounds so
And it was
cool.
really cool, and it's just like one big room, but it's
Yeah.
like only $5 admission or whatever. But me and Drew were like, I want to go. And then he had this really cute dog, and her name was, I think it was like Magnolia or something like that, and he called her Maggie or something.
That's
But it
cute.
was like a small little like coon houndish houndy dog, and he said that she was a feral dog in Colorado, and they adopted her like 2 years ago or something. And she had just been like getting to be a shop dog. She'd only been there for like a couple days, and she's so scared of everybody. And like, I was like literally reaching down and petting her. And he was like, you're like the only, like the second person ever that she has let pet them. And I was like, oh, dogs and cats really like me. And I was like, plus we have like a really traumatized female dog at home too, and she was a little street feral dog in Nashville,
Similar
so
story.
that might be why. But then at the end, Drew was like letting her pet her, letting him pet her and everything too. But it was really cool. And then Drew brought up that, oh yeah, I have a paranormal and true crime podcast,
Yeah.
because I never bring it up.
It's
Because
my
I've
private hobby. Don't talk to me
well,
about
no, I just feel like
it.
I don't want to be one of those people,
No,
you
oh yeah,
know,
I
that
have a
like goes
podcast.
in and
No, I
I'm.
never it comes up in conversation when I'm talking about something I'm doing with you.
I
Oh
know,
yeah,
I'm
I have to
like,
go, we have to go
record
record
my.
today, or I
Yeah,
was
and then they're
doing
like, record what?
or I, when I like want to preemptively share the research I've done, where I'm like
Yeah.
too excited I need to share it now, and they'll be like, okay, and they're like, why were you looking this up in depth? And I was like, oh, it's for me and Audrey's podcast.
I know, I don't tell anybody. Drew tells everybody, but I don't, because it's not like embarrassing, but like, I just don't want to seem like an attention seeker.
Exactly. No, I 100% agree with that.
But
I think
anyway,
it was really
so.
cute that Katie and Leah both
I
listened to it.
know.
They're
I
like, it's
said,
like,
don't tell me that.
no, and then, but no, I liked what Katie said. She's like, so it felt like I've been able to hang out with you guys.
I
Like,
know,
you're
it was
far away.
so
And I was like, actually,
cute.
that's really
It
cute. That's like the
is.
best comment you can come out, like, they can come out of that.
Yeah. But, So Drew brought it up, and well, because I was saying, because he had like a camel saddle in there, and like a lot of stuff, I was like, oh, I've got this stuff in my office, I got this stuff in my office. Like saying it to Drew, not to the guy.
Yeah.
Because I was like, this is what I want our house to look like. And Drew was like, okay. But, I was like, and I've got this in my office. And the guy was like, he was like at the cash register. Like, he's really friendly and like talks to everybody that's in the museum, like asks if they have any questions or whatever. And like, so like point out stuff that you might like not look at or whatever. And he was like, what's that? And Drew was like, oh, she has a camel saddle in her office. And he was like, oh, where do you work? And then Drew was like, well, she. And I was like, oh, I just have like an office at home. Like, I work online as a social media
Yeah.
moderator, blah, blah, blah. And then Drew was like, and she has a paranormal podcast. And I was like, yeah, and true crime. And he was like, oh, that's really cool. He was like, we get a lot of paranormal podcasters that come through here. Like, if you guys ever want to come and like record here or like whatever, like I'll take you to this certain part of like the hotel and you guys can record an episode there and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, I'll have to let my sister know. So he was probably like, why would she tell her sister? Because I didn't say, like, yeah, me and my sister do it together.
Yeah.
But no, it was really cool. I definitely recommend it to anybody who's listening. It's fun. It's only $5
Yeah,
for a cute little
it's a good
thing.
cheap
They have a
activity.
really good, like, shop across from it that's owned by them too.
Mm-hmm.
And they sell like t-shirts and stuff, but they sell like a bunch of crystals and like witchy, like potion-y like stuff too. Yeah. It was really cool.
It just sounds like a great Halloween.
It was really fun.
Season activity.
It was really fun. But yeah, so we went there and then, so this is what I really wanted to talk about. There was this one painting there that's like a painting of a seance that was in the house of an old Playboy like bunny who committed suicide in front of it when she was like 50 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And so he was saying like how haunted it was and everything else, and like whenever we walked in I kept like staring at the painting, and like I was literally standing right by when he was like explaining everything that happened with it, but I'm like staring at it and he's like, it's so haunted, like blah 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 blah, and I'm sitting there like staring at it and I'm like, I feel nothing. Like, I literally feel nothing looking at this. Like, it's not even, like, really... To me, it's not spooky. To other people, yeah. It might be. It's kind of creepy looking, but, like, to me, it isn't. And then, whenever we were in the car going home, I looked at Drew and I was like, you know, I've never really thought about it, but, like, with the psychic saying, like, I'm into really dark stuff and, like, I'm, like, witchy and, like, psychic and all this other stuff, I was like, maybe I never... Because I was like, every time we go somewhere that's supposed to be really haunted and you're supposed to feel, you know, a dark presence and blah, 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 or you're just supposed to feel like, depressed or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was like, I've never gone anywhere and felt like that at any place ever. Not a single location. I was like, maybe if I am into all the dark stuff, like the lady was saying, like the first two tarot cards she pulled mm-hmm. was Death and the Devil or whatever. I don't remember which one was first, but like, maybe if I'm into all the dark stuff, like I'm just so used to that kind of like energy that I don't feel it in haunted places.
I was like, the only two places I've ever felt.
Because I've never felt like, oh, there's an evil presence here.
There's three places. Three places I've ever felt anything other than just like normal energies. One was just like the absolute, totally consuming sadness of like Buchenwald concentration camp. And that makes sense.
That makes sense.
That's just, yeah. It's such terrible things happen.
Well, because knowing that, everybody knows that history, so I feel like even if it isn't haunted or whatever,
people are
like, you just feel
sad energy
sad
into
because
it still. Exactly. I'm not saying it's haunted.
There.
I'm saying it's the only place I've felt energy that's
no,
not
that's
just
what I'm saying.
Energy.
I said, even though, like, even if it isn't haunted,
one of three. The second place was in Alton, Illinois, in that basement, that very first episode we ever did on this podcast when I told about that time. That time, truly a malevolent
spirit.
I still need
to go there and see what I feel. Or I'll
like
probably
was,
get something
so
attached to me and take it home.
Because, like, it wasn't... The person wasn't describing anything that should have triggered that kind of feeling in you, right? And I don't generally feel that kind of... alarm unless I'm like deep in the woods and I literally because this has happened before, I've literally heard like mountain lions screaming in the woods at me.
Yeah.
Like that's
well I feel like spooked in the woods, but I've never felt like a haunting
something wants
presence.
To hurt me. No, the only other time I can describe it is when I heard a mountain lion do its lady
scream.
A
literal wild animal.
Yeah. And then the only other time I felt anything odd was when I felt less than nothing. And felt totally comfortable, like should not have felt that comfortable in a hotel, kind of comfortable when we were at that haunted
that
like castle mansion
in
Michigan. I forget which town. It's the fun named town. It, like it starts with a K or something. It's like in the middle of the state, not on the coast. That's those are the three places I've ever felt anything.
Yeah.
So energies exist out there. I just don't think there is. I think people get themselves hyped up one way or another.
I do too, because it's not like I go in like we were watching what is it, the Ghost Files with like Shane and Ryan, mm-hmm. the two guys that were on like that BuzzFeed mm-hmm. Unsolved or whatever. We were watching that last night and Shane was like, I'm open and receptive. And I was like, I feel like that's how I feel every time I go somewhere and just want to see a ghost or like want something to happen to me, but like literally nothing ever happens. Like I think sometimes like I'll watch a scary movie at my house and then I feel like someone's watching me.
But that's just...
But it's like, I don't...
You're getting revved up.
I know, I'm like, I never think it's like my house is haunted. I'm just like, okay, stop watching scary stuff alone and then mm-hmm. you won't feel that way. But... I don't know. I was just asking. And then I was talking to Corey about it, and I was like, I don't know. It makes sense to me, but, like, no one I talk to about this besides Sadie is into the paranormal stuff and would even, like,
well,
think of an explanation
for
this.
Most of the people I know who are haven't gone a lot of places to experience a lot of things. We've had the ability to go to a lot of places people will never go into.
Yeah.
Whether it's because they wouldn't think to stop there, or it's because they just don't have that opportunity to travel to those locations. Uh-huh. And it's not that we've traveled, like, far and wide. I mean, like,
as we some people have.
I guess we've done a lot
of trips. We haven't gone, like, super far in the U.S. We've kind of just gone up and down from where we are. Yeah,
but we've done it extensively. We've made sure to stop at everything one can stop at along the way.
And that's another thing, like, we've been to so many, like, Civil War battlefields and everything else, but, like, I literally feel nothing anywhere I go. I'm like, oh, that's it's a very pretty hilly place.
I've been allowed to put on glasses that were, like, somebody died in a Civil War battlefield, and they're just, like, in the back of a museum now. Like, I've been able to just fondle all of the bullets that have been in people's limbs and never, like, encountered anything insane, and I would consider those great potential for haunted objects. Yeah. Like, we've had a crazy amount of opportunities people don't have.
Maybe we're too open and receptive that the ghosts are like, well, there's no point in trying to scare them. I don't know.
Like, I psych myself out.
I'm not saying I want to get possessed or anything. No. I'm just saying I wish I would feel things like other people say they do. One of my worst fears is still
just seeing an entire ghost or just being tormented by one, but at the same time,
I want to see ghosts, and I say that all the time. I'm like, man, what I would give, but I never...
I guess my fear is to be in a place that I can't leave and then also have a haunting happening. Like, not being able to leave. Like, if I'm in a haunted house for a haunted house tour, great time to experience a ghost. Living in the middle of the, like, remote Virginia wilderness in a shed, I don't need you to tell me a ghost story that may or may not be true. It is an entirely made up ghost story. It doesn't matter to me. Now you've convinced me that it's a possibility for this location, and I have to sleep here alone.
Well, it's like
on the
at fifth grade camp, whenever what was his name, Mr. Simpkins, was telling us that a bunch of kids got murdered at the old cabins that they don't use anymore and everything else, and the killer's never given caught and all this other stuff. I don't even think it was real, but I was like, why would you tell a bunch of fifth graders that?
They can't leave. That'll only freak them out
and
more.
And they're not bothered. Like, I understand you think it's funny, but. That's a bunch of kids who are homesick and, like, have never left their parents for that long. Oh, anyway.
It's not cool.
But, no, I was like, maybe I'm just into such dark stuff that, like, nothing that dark
would ever
phase me.
That is not truly dark. It doesn't.
Or even if it is, like, my psychic literally told me I have a witch woman attached to me who looks like the literal Wicked Witch of the West, essentially. Not, like, actually like that, but she says she seems like this is what she looks like and described
this
it.
This vibe? Matches your sleep paralysis.
And she was
demon.
Like, it wasn't even sleep paralysis. But she was saying, like, I'm not saying, like, she's evil. She just looks like she's evilish, like, evil witch looking is what she looks like. And then she described the little witch I've seen in my dreams. So I'm like, if I have that kind of stuff already going on, like, it would make sense if I never feel the presence of evil or whatever they say it is, because I've already got that looming over me every day, apparently. I don't think she's evil, though. She doesn't seem very bothersome.
She just looks a little haggard.
She might be my spirit guide or something. Who knows?
Is your past life?
Who knows? No, literally, she was like, because she was like, before we go on in our session, I just want to say, like, there's something attached to you. Because with Hannah, it was, like, literally her great-grandma, which was, like, so sweet and, like, was telling her all this stuff. Like, she's always there for you. She tries to keep you out of harm's way, blah, blah. And then she goes, you have this spirit attached to you. She's a witch. and then she's like describing her and everything, and I'm like, because it's literally the woman I've seen in my dreams. And then she's like, do you know who she is? And I said, I don't have a clue. I said, I have no clue who she is, but I've seen her in my dreams, and I've had multiple dreams with her in it. And she was like, oh,
that's so wild.
She literally was like, oh, it's very interesting. And then later, like, she goes on and she's saying how, like, oh, you're into really dark stuff that nobody wants to get into. And I was like, I want to see you do a reading on Zach Bagans and see if I'm darker than he is, because I can guarantee you I am. Oh, it was so funny. But yeah, I was like, maybe I should talk about it on the podcast, because it is, like, it's a good theory, I guess, because, like, maybe there are other people like me who, like, they're like, well, I believe and I want to see stuff and blah, blah, but, like, I've never felt anything.
Or maybe,
like,
you're
never
just used
seen
to
a
it
ghost
and it's,
or
you're
blah,
actually
blah,
feeling
blah.
It all the time and don't
know
that that's not.
Yeah, and that's why
it.
I'm saying, like, maybe other people have the same kind of thing that I do. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, I'm happy you have something to talk about, because, like, I have, like, a bare minimum banter, because sometimes we're lacking.
I know. Next week, I'm not going to have any banter. Well,
instead,
because
I'll
what
just,
do we both do? We literally work all day. Yeah. Well, I guess I'll have banter because we're going to that concert.
Yeah, well, we can talk about the concert.
And a wedding.
We have a wedding, too.
Yep.
Fun.
It's a real... That's why I was trying... I had to write a 13-page research paper is what I've been doing this week.
So you can be ready for the concert.
Yeah, because we have rehearsal dinner Saturday. It's like a rehearsal brunch dinner thing.
Oh, that's nice.
But we're going to try to leave around 4 so we can get ready to go to the concert. And then Sunday we have the wedding, which is basically all day. Mm-hmm. And then back to working and doing more homework again. So it's like really busy this weekend. Everybody buckle up. If you don't like true crime, this ain't the episode for you.
Sorry. Next week we can do double paranormal.
Yeah, we can. We could even just do double paranormal for the rest of
October. It was an interesting story.
But I like finding true crimes.
So it's the Isle of Shoals. And the Isle of Shoals is a little group of islands that are off the coast of Maine and New Hampshire. And they like split them down the middle. So half of them belong to Maine and half of them belong to New Hampshire. Yeah. And it's like just at random. So my sources are Wikipedia, Only in Your State, and New England Today Travel. It's like the New England Today newspaper travel edition. So as I said, their Isle of Shoals are located off the coast of Maine and New Hampshire. Might have said New England the entire time there. It's New Hampshire. All of it's New England. So they're looking
about... Also, everybody disregard the dogs barking. They're just gonna do it. We got home before other people got home, so they're going to be barking at people coming in the door.
So the islands are all located about 6 miles off the coast. They're all itty-bitty dudes. That's why they're called the Isles.
Yeah.
So the islands have a long history of fishing-based inhabitants predating European contact, but never, like, there's no evidence of, like, permanent inhabitants there, but, like, they know that, like, native populations were definitely doing, like, temporary fishing villages there.
Yeah.
Because they're just sort of, like, little gross, rocky,
it's like a summer
islands. So the islands were first settled by European colonists in the early 17th century. Originally, they were recorded as the Smith Isles by the English explorer Captain John Smith in 1614. I do believe it is the
is that the Pocahontas?
Yeah, the Pocahontas John Smith.
Not the Pocahontas guy.
That was my thought too when I saw it.
I truly have never cared about any of that history. I don't care about
the concept of him being real is wild
really
to me.
I know, I was like, oh, a Disney character is a real person? I don't think so. But like, I always, like, Pocahontas, like, yeah, she's real.
But
I was
yeah, like, well, everyone else is not real. So the they changed the name to the Isle of Shoals in 1916. I'm going to continue to do that because 6 and 9 are too close and my dyslexia says no. So in 1623, when Captain Christopher Levitt made the first European landfall on the islands. So, like, John Smith, like, rode by, said, rocks, those are mine.
Let's name them.
And then continued.
Why is it the shoals? Why did they pick that name?
I think it's just a lot of shoals. Oh, it's, like, okay. Yeah, they're made up of shoals.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what a shoal is, but I think that sounds right. I know it's some sort of geographical feature.
Yeah.
So this is how Levitt described the islands when he landed on them. Upon these islands, I neither could see one good timber tree, nor so much good ground as to make a garden. The places found to be a good fishing place for 6 ships, but more cannot be well there. For want of convenient stage room. Yeah, there's literally not enough space on the islands. As this year's experience hath proven, so clearly he tried to fish there with more than 6 ships, and it didn't work out.
It did not work. They said, kick out 2 of these ships.
So these are, it's a whole bunch of little teeny islands, and there's only space enough for 6 ships.
Sorry, my foot's falling asleep.
So 5 years after they're renamed and someone actually lands on them, the Plymouth Pilgrims, like, you know, Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Pilgrims,
were
all early Americans are apparently involved with these islands. They exile Thomas Morton to the island.
Who is this?
Thomas Morton, I'd never heard of him before, but he's like wild. So he's technically exiled to the island because he gave the Native Americans guns.
Okay.
Because he thought they deserved to have these handy-dandy weapons.
Yeah.
Because he seemed to have been on pretty decent terms for a white guy and Native people in the olden days. Based on everything, I'm not saying he's, like, a great guy. I'm saying he was definitely better than the others.
Than everybody else, yeah.
They also were accusing him of... This is what I think really did it. It wasn't specifically the guns. More than one person is trading guns with them.
Yeah.
They're not getting exiled. They're really, truly exiling him because he participated in what they said were immoral sexual liaisons with indigenous women in the form of drunken orgies, which they claimed were to be in the honor of Bacchus and Aphrodite. And that is, like, the quick description of these events. What these events actually were was after they had managed to survive some time there, which was a feat because people just would, they would send, there was a bunch of colonies that did not make it.
Yeah.
They just died the first winter.
Like, what's that one that disappeared?
Roanoke.
Yeah.
So they managed to make it a few, at least 1 year, if not more. I don't remember when Plymouth gets there. I'm not from that area to have to know that date by heart. No. Anyway, Morton's like, you know what we should do? We should celebrate the fact that we lived. So he sets up a maypole, a traditional European, like, spring celebration. We survived the winter. Let's party.
Yeah.
Thing. So they set up a maypole, and then they have drinking and dancing and frisking and having a good time. And he invites the native populations because they're their neighbors. Mm-hmm. They live next to each other. It's good to figure out how to coexist so we don't kill each other one way or the other, right? This seems to be his general vibe. He didn't see a need for the two groups to fight.
Yeah.
He thinks they can definitely get along. And he seems to, like, make an effort to learn about how they do things, too. And does, like, writings on it and all that.
He's
recording things. But I don't just mean, like, how they're living. I mean, like, their cultural practices. He even records them. He knows them enough to be able to record them and bother to think they're worth recording, which is really nice of him. So they don't like that. They get mad about that. They say, don't do that. This is bad and immoral because...
They're not white.
No, because they're, like, Puritans.
Yeah.
And don't like fun.
They're also racist.
Yeah, that too. So 2 years later, he throws a second May Day celebration. He goes, okay, things have cooled down. Maybe they're a bit chiller. We're going to do it again. This time he sets up an 80-foot tall maypole, and he tops it with deer antlers, so now it's even more festive looking. And then he and his followers, because he has other people who have said, we're down with this guy, he seems fun. Or the other people are just not fun.
Yeah.
And so they drunkenly dance around it, as you do at a maypole festival. Again, native population is invited. So Miles Standish doesn't like this. Miles Standish is a name you might be familiar with. You might not know why, but he's one of, like, the original founders of Plymouth Rock. He's no fun. So he is also the head of the Plymouth Militia, so he and some of his men go down to the party and cut down the maple and then arrest Morton. Again, they're not saying it's because of the party, because, like, that can't be...
Then they really
that's not
like
good enough.
Poopers.
It's not a good enough reason to banish somebody. But instead... They arrest him because he's been giving the native population guns. So then he's put in stock, he's sent to trial, he's then marooned on the deserted Isles of Shoals. He gets off eventually. Because they said, if somebody happens to pass by and they'll let you on, you get to go with. That was the ruling. People went by because it is a good fishing spot. So they come by. He gets off. I don't know how long he's there. That no one told me. Anyway, he gets off, and then he starts writing a whole bunch of content, books, pamphlets, something. I don't know. It all ends up being one book. In which he denounces the building of forts against the native population because, again, he's like, we should just learn to live together as they already live here.
Yeah.
And we're coming into their space. And he even goes as far as to use the Bible as reference to support why it's not cool for us to push people out of land they're from.
That's right.
So yeah, that's the earliest fun history of these islands is this interesting man. I'm sure he had bad thoughts, but he had some good thoughts, or decent thoughts at least, and he was interesting to learn about because I did not know about him.
Okay, stop whining.
And I think banishment is very amusing
in
history because people, it's always for, like, the weirdest things that people get banished.
Yeah, it's just because somebody doesn't like them. Yep. And then they're like, hey, I don't like them, you don't like them either, and they're like, all right, let's get rid of them.
Now you live in the desert.
It's really just Survivor.
Mm-hmm. And if they make it back, they make it back. So anyway, there's, like, you know, more, obviously more history happens. This is in the 1600s. Things happen in between. We're not covering it. It's already four pages long. That's too much. So instead, we're going to focus on the specific island where our true crime event happens.
Right.
So this is the island of Smutty Nose.
And I will have to say,
I will have to say this name so many more times.
I said, I think I might know the Snorri. Am I all right?
You heard nose. So, Smutty Nose Island is 25 acres and the third largest island of the Isles. It was also allegedly where Blackbeard went for his honeymoon to this gross rock in the ocean.
Interesting. Out of all the places
today,
the sea, that's
where
he decides.
Exactly two buildings that remain on the island, and people now, like, maintain them so they don't, I don't know, rot away.
Yeah.
But nobody lives there otherwise. There's nothing else happening other than these two buildings.
Yeah.
So now we get to our story. So in the 1870s, Marin and John Hontvedt were the only people living on Smutty Nose Island. They moved there in 1868 from Norway. John worked as a fisherman, going out daily on his schooner, Clarabella, and then going to sell his catch at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, or in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. So he goes out, catches his fish, goes to Portsmouth, sells his fish, buys bait, goes back home. That's his day. So that's what they do. That's their lives. He fishes, she sits at home. 2 years after they arrived, Lewis Wagner arrived in the area. So he's arrived as a fisherman in the area. He was about 28 at the time, and he was from Prussia. He had a thick accent. So others from the surrounding area did not necessarily think well of Lewis. He never spoke of his past, and he had a tendency to lurk and eavesdrop. He was just a bit odd and a little bit freaky for the general population. But however, he was pleasant to the Hontvedts, and they eventually became friends. So the Hontvedts did well on the island, but Marin was lonely, only having a little dog named Ringa to keep her company most days. So her sister Karen Christiansen moved from Norway to live with them. Which that seems common for a lot of U.S. Yeah. immigrants. I'm lonely here. Come over. It's not bad.
Yeah.
So Karen quickly got a job as a live-in maid on a family in Appledore Island, which is the largest island in the Isle of Shoals. But you can, like, see the islands from each other.
Yeah.
Like, they're super close. And a number of them have, like, some kind of breaks. Water breaks, wave breaks, something like that. Like, those weird seawalls you see.
Yeah.
It places. A lot of the times associated with, like, lighthouses. They have those going between a lot of the islands, so you can technically walk, but it's, like, dangerous because it's thin.
Yeah.
So, like, she's immediately in the area. They can hang out now. In June of 1872, business was going super well, so John hired on Lewis and provided him a room in their house. So now he has room and board plus a job, which is a pretty good deal. But by October the same year, his brother, John's brother, Matthew, and then Marin's brother, Ivan Christiansen, and his wife, I think it's Annetta, moved into the house. Like, clearly he had written, and they said, "We shall also come because the fishing is good."
Yeah. No. I don't.
So now they have three new people moving in, and Ivan and Annetta had just gotten married right before they came to New England. So they're it's just their whole new life together, and they're excited about it. So the men all worked together. So all five men, including Lewis, worked together for 5 weeks until Lewis took his leave. Cause I think he assumed it was going to be coming eventually. Cause John now had more help than he needed.
Yeah.
So he took his leave, went back to the mainland, to get a new job. He found a job working for the fishing schooner Addison Gilbert. And I think even John and, oh, whatever. What's his wife? Marin. They'd also not only been lodging him, they'd also been clothing him. They'd been providing with him with clothing. And then they had sent him off with more clothing and, like, extra pay. And then I think helped him get this job on the Addison Gilbert. So, like, we've done good by him. You know, like, we brought this family in. He doesn't have a job anymore. We did that. We know that. But also, there you go, sir. Off into the world. You adult man who's in his 30s now. So a short while later, the Addison Gilbert wrecked, and this left Lewis jobless. And by March, and I mean a short while later, I mean like in the same year.
Yeah, like a few months later.
Yeah. So by March, he was entirely destitute, like threadbare clothing and worn through shoes. Like, I feel a little bit bad for him because that's a whole nother level of poor. So March 5th, 1873, the men, as in the family, the three men of the family, head out to fish like normal. Along the way, they meet some neighbors who are heading back to the Isles. And they ask them to send word to the women that they would not be stopping back by the island like they usually do to drop off one of the men before they went into town, because the winds favor that they just go straight to the mainland.
Yeah.
So the women will be by themselves until later. So once they arrive at the mainland, as in the men, they're met by Lewis, who asks if they were going to be returning to the island that night. They said it depends on whether or not the train... It depended on when the train that had the bait arrived, because remember, they buy bait there every day.
Yeah.
And if it came on the late train, then they would have to stay the night, because they have to bait up their hooks before they head out, and if by that point, it's going to be too late, stay at the tavern or something, right?
Yeah.
They offer to pay Lewis to help them bait up the hooks. He says, sure, I'll be back when the bait comes in. And then he leaves, because they don't need him right now. So Lewis is last seen on the mainland around 7:30 p.m. That night, the quarter moon provided enough light to be able to navigate the first calm waters of the year. So it's not choppy ocean, like winter ocean. It's nice. It's a nice night. Hold on, I'm missing a detail. The bait does come in on the late train, so the men will have to stay the night. Wagner finds this out and leaves for a smutty nose, because he knows the men won't be back. So he has the intent of robbing their house while they're gone, because he knows their business has been going well. There should be something of financial value there. So he rows the 12 miles to Smutty Nose to rob the house. Because he thinks, well, the women are gone, he can subdue the women and take enough to go start somewhere else at this point, because clearly he's not able to find work here.
Yeah.
So at the house, the women had first decided to wait up for dinner because they weren't sure. Again, the men didn't even know when they were coming back. It all depended on which train the bait was on.
Yeah.
So they waited up later than normal for the men to return with dinner. But by 10, they decided, nope, we're done. We're sleepy. It's time to go to bed. So they start to go to bed. They turn in. That night, Karen is also on the island visiting, because, you know, she lives nearby now.
Yeah.
Marin fixes her a bed in the kitchen, and then Marin and Annetta go to sleep in the adjoining bedroom on the ground floor. During this, like, going to bed process, Wagner has rowed up on the far side of the island, which is not where the cove is, where they normally dock the schooners, so that he can watch the house from a distance, and he, like, sees that they're still up, and so he has to wait for the lights to go out, and then he even waits a little bit longer to make sure they're fully asleep before he approaches the home. So he walks into the house, and the door is unlocked because they live on an island alone. There's not really people there to do anything. And plus, the men may yet show up that night. You don't know what might happen. So anyway, he walks in with no issue. He goes over to the bedroom door and jams a piece of wood under it, where Marin and Annette are sleeping, so that they won't come out while he's robbing the house. The goal is to lock them in there. If he does make noise, they can't immediately get out, and he can skedoodle with things. As he continues to rob the house, he makes like just enough noise to wake up the dog Ringa, who begins barking, as dogs do when someone is in their house at night making noise.
Okay.
This wakes up Karen, who is sleeping in the kitchen and not locked in a room. And she sees Lewis's silhouette against the window and asks, John, is that you? Which is a reasonable assumption.
Yeah.
Marin then calls, asking if something to Karen, like, is something wrong, Karen? Like, why are you awake and talking to somebody? Yeah. So Karen, who is still half asleep, replies, John scared me. And then out of nowhere, from the darkness, she is struck by a chair. So she starts screaming, and Wagner continues to beat her with the chair. Because she's now a witness, and we'll know him, because remember, he lived there with these people. She would have been everybody over to visit. Everybody
knows him, yeah.
Yeah. So Karen ran to the bedroom door and was able to tug it open, because the women inside were not be able to get it out, because there's a... it's been jammed shut.
Yeah.
She tugs it open, she falls at Marin's feet. Lewis strikes both women with the chair... as Marin is dragging Karen out of reach into the bedroom, and Marin, and during all this, is yelling at Annetta to run and hide. So Annetta manages to climb out of the window in the bedroom, barefoot into the snow, and then just freezes. She does not have a great fight or flight response, apparently.
Yeah.
At this point, Wagner's like, I'm not getting into the bedroom, because I think they managed to, like, even close the door.
Yeah.
This is not the best way to deal with this now. Very different situation than what I believe he intended on having happen.
Well, yeah, because you wouldn't lock them in their rooms if you planned on killing them.
So they decide, he decides to go after the runner, which, if the goal is to get witnesses, we gotta get the ones that are trying to get out of the way first. So he goes around to the back of the house, to where the window, the other side of the house, to where Annetta had gone out of the window. And in the moonlight, they can finally see him, because it's dark at the house.
Yeah.
And Annetta yells, Lewis, Lewis, as Wagner reaches for the axe in the woodpile and with one stroke drives the wedge into her head, killing her.
Oof.
But now we know who it is. No one else has to see him. He's been identified. So Marin watches this all from the window that Annetta climbed out of, because Annetta did not go far. And she watches in horror as Lewis continues to chop at her body.
Yeah. To make sure she's dead.
Mm-hmm. And Marin later describes that he was so close she could have reached out of the window and touched his arm.
Yeah.
So it's she's crazy lucky that he was in such a frenzy that he didn't turn and attack him through the window. Because clearly a person can go through the window. So Marin turns from the window. She's like, I clearly cannot do anything to help Annetta. We need to... get out of here, like, as in her and Karen. So she tries to rouse Karen to run away, but her sister is so badly beaten at this point that all Karen can do is, like, lay there and respond, no, too tired.
Save
like,
yourself. Dot, dot, dot.
No, too tired. She can't even think of anything else. Like, she's probably dying from, like, internal bleeding. Marin can tell this, that she, one, can't carry her, two, her sister is not going to be woken up quickly enough, if at all, to be able to get out of there in time for either of them to survive. So she has the forethought enough to grab a heavy skirt and wrap herself in it and pick up Ringa, because Ringa's a little dog.
Yeah.
And escape through the window, because at this point Wagner has, snapped out of it and is now going to go back inside, because now he has a better weapon.
Yeah.
To more successfully do his job. So he's re-entering the house as she leaves out the window and runs to the cove, where she assumed Lewis's boat would be, because that's where you dock your boat.
Yeah.
She is shocked not to find the boat there. So then she's, like, looking around, what the heck does she do next? Because her goal is to just leave the island.
Yeah.
So she first considers hiding in a vacant building that's near the cove, but she's like, nope, Wagner will for sure look for me there, and instead decides to run along the shore. Where there's no snow, so he can't necessarily know exactly where she went and where she stopped. As she's running around the coast to get to the back side of the island, hoping that'll be, like, the furthest point, even though it's technically where he parked his boat.
Yeah.
She doesn't know that yet. Anyway, she passes by the house and hears Karen scream, but she has to keep going. She has...
Yeah.
This woman has the will to survive. She eventually finds a spot between two large rocks just outside of the waterline, and she and Ringa, she wraps them up in the extra skirt she has, and they sit there and hide between the rocks. So, back in the house, while Marin has been trying to figure out where to hide, where to leave, where to get to, Karen has gained enough consciousness back that she's trying to get through the window, but she's heavily injured. So at this point, Wagner's made it back inside. He has the axe with him. He takes the axe. He swings it. He misses her. He ends up hitting the windowsill, and he does it with such force that he breaks the handle. Oof. So that weapon is out of the picture now.
No more.
But Karen has now fainted because she rightly so thought she was just immediately going to die or be in, like, the most immense pain she's ever experienced in her life.
Yeah.
So Wagner takes advantage of her not trying to leave, move anymore, escape anymore, takes out a handkerchief and strangles her to death. So Wagner now is going to go search for the last witness, Marin. He searches all over the island as long as he can. And he leaves, they know exactly where he went because he leaves a bloody trail of footprints in the snow. Because he searched every structure, every building, every possible place he thought that one could hide on the island.
There's a vicious pit bull attack going on outside the door.
Squeak, squeak, squeak.
She finally picked up a toy and isn't attacking Mom anymore. You heard her say, good girl. I'm so glad I trained her to do that.
It's a very good
But sometimes there's not a toy soon enough.
Mm-hmm. So he has to give up because he needs to escape the island in the cover of darkness. He can't search forever.
Yeah.
And there's also a slight possibility she made it off the island or just went into the sea. Like,
yeah.
You don't know. So he goes back to the house. He drags Annetta's body into the kitchen, because remember, she's killed outside. Drags her into the kitchen, lays her down, which happens to be next to the clock that he had broken in the initial scuffle, which stopped 7 minutes past one. So we now know exactly when he first attacks Karen.
Yeah.
He then makes a cup of tea. We know this because he leaves a bloody handprint on the pot.
It's something about these axe murderers. They always are just like, you know, I want to make myself at home.
Right? He then eats some food he brought with him, but uses the haunt vet's, like, dishes. And then steals $15 because it's all he could find and left.
Wow.
It's $15 and then money. I forgot to convert that. So it's, like, slightly more than $15, but still not...
Not enough.
Not enough to kill two people.
No.
And he doesn't know the fate of Marin, so... She could have been dead, too, really, from exposure or something. Yeah. So Marin did not leave her hiding spot until about 8 that next morning. To be, like, super extra sure that he was definitely gone. Or at least hoping that, like, maybe the men would return by then.
Yeah.
I think there was a combo of those two. And she tries to get the attention of the workers on a neighboring island. Has no luck. So she managed to scuttle across a breakwater, not all the way, but, like, enough that eventually the children of Jorga Ingebredsen, they noticed, they were playing outside, and they noticed her on the breakwater, so they alerted their dad. He paddles over, she tells them what happened. I think she gets on the boat with him, and they go back to the island he's on, because he's on Appledore.
Yeah.
He's not going to leave her there.
Yeah.
He then goes and gets men from the surrounding isles. They get guns. They search Smutty Nose. And then once they've sufficiently searched Smutty Nose, they search the other islands just in case he had, like, you know, run across the breakwaters or something. They don't know where anybody is. They're double checking. Need to make sure their families are safe. So the Smutty Nose men, Marin's family finally return. They see signals on Appledore that clearly there's a distress situation happening. So Matthew and Ivan hop in the rowboat and row ashore, and John continues with the schooner back to Smutty Nose. Ivan and Matthew run to the Ingebredsen house, and Ivan is frantically asking after his wife because he sees Marin there. Definitely not okay, right? All Marin could manage to answer, because she's still in, like, shock, is that she is at home. So they rush to Smutty Nose. They manage to row fast enough that they get to Smutty Nose the same time that John does. And remember, John didn't stop. Went straight there. Get into the house, and they find Annetta and Karen dead. John and some other men then sail to Portsmouth and alert the authorities. Give them a description of Louis Wagner. The description is telegraphed throughout all the coastal states. And in the evening edition of the newspaper, details of both, like, Lewis's description and everything that transpired are published. So yeah. this is part of the reason we know so much is because they immediately published it all.
Uh-huh.
And Marin lived. Yeah. And then we have a whole bunch of, like, time-stamped evidence. Like the broken clock and the path he took because of the bloody footprints. So, two men who happened to both know Wagner reported seeing him that morning in Newcastle, like the morning of the murder, around 6. So now we know he at least got back to the mainland around then.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how close Newcastle is, but I'm not entirely sure he went back to Portsmouth because that might not be smart. Oh no, he did. Never mind. Here we go. He gets to Portsmouth, goes back to the place where he'd been lodging, changes some of his clothes, boards the 9 a.m. train to Boston. Some point in time, he's in Newcastle. I don't know if that's before or after he gets to Portsmouth, because again, I don't know where Newcastle is. But we have a positive ID that he's definitely back on the mainland.
Okay.
Now he's on a train to Boston. He gets to Boston, buys new boots, buys a new suit, puts the new suit on over the clothes he'd been wearing. Then dallies with some women he knew at a boarding house, and I don't know what that means exactly, if he just happened to genuinely know these women, was chatting with them, or if it was a different kind of dallies.
Yeah.
That wasn't specified. And he's soon arrested by Boston police because, you know,
everybody knows
this has happened. So he is transported back to Portsmouth, where, according to newspapers, a horde of 10,000 people waited. Seems like a lot of people. I don't know if that many lived in Portsmouth in the 1870s. But that's what the newspapers recorded. They're all hoping for an opportunity to personally tear him apart, according to the newspapers.
Well.
So that's fun. But people are just enraged, because it was terrible.
Yeah.
And not normal. And it was a little, they lived alone on a little fishing island. Like, if they're not safe, you're not safe, you know?
Yeah.
Makes people, people don't like being uncomfortable when they think everything's okay.
Yeah.
So while being transported from Portsmouth to Maine, because Smutty Nose is technically in Maine and Portsmouth is in New Hampshire, he has to go to Maine for his trial. A lynch mob of 200 fishermen attempt to take justice in their own hands. They are easily fended off because, again, they're not trying to get in trouble. They just want to make sure he
gets
the justice he deserves. The police and the Marines that were brought in, they've been called in from a nearby Navy base because they clearly, people did show up in Portsmouth when he originally arrived, because they had the forethought enough to call in the Marines to make sure that the escort was successful. So the mob was subdued. They didn't, like, charge or anything, because you don't want to get beaten up and or shot at / killed, you know, for the sake of this guy, right? So they decide to just then pelt the escort, as in his police escort, with rocks and bricks. that's what they decided to get out their frustration. I think that seems reasonable. So Lewis Wagner is convicted of his crimes, and he is hanged June 25th, 1875. So 2 years after he is charged, which is a quick turnaround rate. Marin and John move out of the house. You can't stay there anymore.
No.
They move to Portsmouth, and John continues working as a fisherman. Ivan, you know, the newlywed, they're still in their honeymoon phase of love. Hasn't even been a year. He gets a job as a carpenter in Appledore for the rest of that summer that the event happened, where he could always see the cottage where he lived with his beloved. He didn't speak unless spoken to, and didn't look at you when he was speaking. And at the end of the summer, he returned to Norway and was never heard from again, which is saying something because he is Marin's brother.
That's so sad.
So I assume he did not live long after he returned to Norway.
No.
That's really sad. I just liked how detailed it was for an old timey. It's 1873. We know exactly when he hit Karen the first time with the chair, like, or at least one of the first few times when he initially attacked her. It seems like a story that's probably been told before, but I don't remember it.
I've heard it before, but
it also could be like names were said to a point that I didn't recognize them.
Yeah. No, but I like that story. But
Little Ring, yeah. I swear. You got everybody killed, bud. I don't think, I mean, I guess if he had managed to get out of there without waking up Karen, maybe everything would have been okay, but...
Gotta be loud.
Oh, he's just tromping around in boots.
Yeah.
But yeah, the dog is the one that woke her up.
Whenever I was looking up true crime and, like, whatever stories for New England, I saw that one.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking of covering it, but then I, like, read it and realized, like, I knew the story.
I listened to so little true crime stuff.
Yeah.
Just, like, even before we started doing this, I listened to none of it now.
No, but whenever I was looking it up, they said that there's, like, a big theory that it wasn't actually that guy who killed them.
Oh.
But I can't find the article that I saw.
And that he was just framed?
Yeah.
Because he was, like, a poor foreigner?
Yeah.
That's upsetting.
Yeah.
I didn't look into theories. I just looked up the story.
Because I saw something that it wasn't this guy, and it had the name of another guy, but I'm not going to be able to find it when I'm looking for it now.
Mm-hmm. That's always how it works.
But anyway, so we'll start on my story. So my story is about the James Purrington family massacre. I got my information from Ancestry.com, TouringMaineHistory.com, DOHistory.com, LOC.gov, Q1065.fm, gravestonecollector.blogspot.com, and murdershetold.com. So, Captain James Scales Purrington, which is the weirdest middle name I've ever seen,
Purrington?
Was born on September 17th, 1759, in Lincoln County, Maine. In 1805, James, age 46, moved to Augusta, Maine, in August with his wife, Elizabeth Betsy, who was 45, and their 8 kids, Polly 19, James 17, Martha 15, Benjamin 12, Anna 10, Nathaniel 8, Nathan 6, why would you have those two names? Louisa, who was 1.5. They put her in months, and I'm so sick.
Nathaniel and Nathan.
Yeah, I don't know why you would do that, but they put her in, like, however many months that is, and I just hate when people do that. I'm like, if they're past a year, say how old they are. Don't keep doing months, because that's so stupid. This was around the time he received a good amount of money that he inherited from his father. And they actually had 12 kids, but 4 of them died in infancy, which is, mm-hmm. you know, how it was back then. So, they moved into a farm on the Belgrade Road, which is still a road today, that was owned by the late George Coney, who built the Coney House. Which, I don't know what that is, but that was in, like, all the articles, so I'm assuming it's
something. The Coney House.
Yeah. Anyway, James was described as, quote, an independent farmer with a handsome estate of steady, correct, and industrious habits, of good character and fair reputation, and strongly attached to his family. He was also said to avoid eye contact when speaking to people, and would go from happy to depressed relatively quickly. Bipolar, maybe. The neighbors said he was always willing to help anybody in need, though. So, a little off, but like a friendly mm-hmm. family person.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the summer of 1806, the family was kind of running into hard times. There was a drought in the area, and their crops hadn't yet been, like, actually affected by it, but I guess, like, he thought they were going to be affected by it. And so I guess either they started, you know, to kind of get weepy or whatever, or droopy, I mean. And the same with their cattle was kind of, you know, like, I'm hot, give me more water, mm-hmm. I guess. So James wrote a letter on July 6th, 1806, to his brother, saying that he had been having suicidal thoughts, and the note read something kind of like, Dear brother, these lines are to let you know that I am going on a long journey, and I would have you sell what I have. Put my boys out to trade or send them out to sea. I cannot see the distress of my family. God only knows my distress. I would have you put Nathaniel to Uncle Purrington to a tanner's trade. I want James to go to school until sufficient enough to attend a store. Benjamin to a blacksmith's trade, or to what you think is best. Be sure to give them learning if it takes all. learning. Oh, that means be sure to pay for their schooling. And if that takes all the money that he has, divide what is left for I am no more. He sealed the letter with black wax and drew a human skull on it.
So dramatic.
And I literally wrote in parentheses, dramatic. Anyway, he hid the letter in the home, but his oldest daughter, Polly, saw the letter and asked him what it was about. He didn't answer her question and asked her to go get some sharpened steel, which was like the family's butcher knife or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he sharpened it more, like, in his... I guess he was, like, in his room when he was writing this or something, and probably, like, saw him writing it and sealing it and whatever. So then he sharpened it some more in his room, and then stood in front of the mirror and gestured with it as if he were, like, slitting his own throat. And it, like, scared the crap out of Polly, and she said, "What are you doing?" And he just said, "Nothing."
Gosh.
Or whatever they would have said back in that day that was, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when Elizabeth got home, Polly went looking for the letter and found it and read it and then gave it to her mom. And Elizabeth was so distraught by this suicide mm-hmm. note, essentially, that night that she skipped dinner. And when they were all at the dinner table, James was like, "Where's your mom?" And they were like, "I don't know." And so he went looking for her and found her in the barn crying, like her eyes out, mm-hmm. like sobbing.
Yeah.
And he told her he wasn't going to kill himself because she was like, "Why would you write this letter?" And then he was like, "Well, I'm not going to kill myself." But that he had a premonition that he was going to die soon. And that's why he wrote the letter. And he's not suicidal. God forbid. So it was thought that whenever Elizabeth and James had talked about his suicidal thoughts, that he realized it would hurt his family if he killed himself mm-hmm. and left them alone. So on the morning of July 9th, between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, James went through every room in the house and killed every member of the family with an axe.
Oh.
James Jr. heard, you know, some strange noises yeah. in the house, and he woke up. This is the oldest son. So he woke up, and he's in his room, so the door to his room opens, and he saw his father standing in the doorway with an axe. He tried to escape, but his father swung the axe at him and gashed his back open. They struggled, and his younger brother woke up, I think it was Benjamin, and ran for the door. And whenever that happened, it gave him enough time to escape. So James mm-hmm. ran down the road to his neighbor's house and explained what had happened. His neighbor, Dean Wyman, got reinforcements, and they went to the Purrington house. The front door was open, and whenever they got there, so they called out to see if anybody was, you know, still mm-hmm. in there or whatever, and nobody responded, so they went into the house and lit a candle, and when they entered, they saw the body of James on the floor, the dad. It was in the outer room, is what they described it as, so I don't know if that's like a living room or like a...
Who was in the outer room?
James. But it's like the main door they entered through. Anyway, it's the outer room. So, and James is the dad.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they saw him lying on the outer room floor with his throat slit with a folding straight razor on the ground next to him, as well as a bloody axe next to him on the ground. So the two youngest boys were found in the same room. Their throats cut with a razor as well. In the middle of the house, lying on the hearth, was Benjamin, who, with his pants under his arm, like he was grabbing them to leave the house mm-hmm. to go get help. And he had left a bloody handprint on the fireplace.
Oh, that's sad.
In the parents' bedroom, in their bed, was Elizabeth, the mother. Her head almost fully cut off with an axe, by the axe. Some reports said that she was pregnant again, too, so I don't know if that's true or not, or if they just did that to be more dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, like, one report that said, like, her stomach was, like, chopped up, but, like, I don't know if that's true either. So, on the floor by the bed was Anna, who ran to her mother when she heard her screaming. In another bedroom was Polly. Martha, who was still alive, and her head was resting on the body of, baby Louisa, who was also dead. Judging by their wounds, it looked like James had tried to behead almost every member of the family.
Goodness.
They got medical attention for Martha because she was still, like, I think she was still breathing, and that's how they could tell she was still alive. Mm-hmm. And the others were checked to see if they were still alive, too, but nobody else had survived, besides James Jr., who had ran out and gotten help, and Martha, who's barely alive. Mm. So, the neighbors called proper authorities and the coroner, Elias Craig, who summoned a jury of inquest of 11 men in town. The men concluded that James had committed these murders and was considered to be a felon, even though he had killed himself. Like, mm-hmm. I guess they still did that anyway. I don't know. The men were put in charge of taking care of the bodies, so they carried them to the meeting house. But James, since he died by suicide, was denied admission beyond the porch where his body was detained, along with the axe and the razor, which were displayed on his coffin. All of these people were put in coffins and then put into these places. They weren't just, like, laying the bloody bodies in the
But he's in a coffin. He doesn't get to go inside. He has to be on the porch. That's fair.
Well, I read that and I was like, even if he didn't kill himself, I would hope they wouldn't put him with his family that he just murdered with
an axe. Yeah, no, that seems disrespectful to them.
So, news of the murder spread fast, and on Thursday, July 10th, a big crowd had appeared for the funeral, like happens in all of my family massacres for some reason.
Everybody wants to see.
It's always small town, like, massacres. Here, I think that's why.
True crime tourism is not a new thing.
No. Everybody acts like it is, but it's not.
They used to sell teeny tiny little houses of, like, the Lizzie Borden house. Like,
well, and they would sell t-shirts versions. When certain people would get, like, executed in prisons and everything else, and people would stand outside and, like, cheer.
Not a new fad. People have always been fascinated with macabre.
So hundreds of people attended, and a platform was set up in Market Square for the minister. Daniel Stone said the prayer, and Joshua Taylor did the sermon or something else. It's two religious people, I don't know. One was Methodist, one was...
Something else,
I don't remember. But, so, the procession was headed by the coroner and his jury. Behind them were the seven victims' bodies, quote, supported by bearers and attended by pallbearers. I don't know what that means. Anyway, and they were followed by the surviving son, James Jr., and relatives, and, you know, other people in it. Just randos, I guess. And then James' body was hauled on a cart behind.
I have to assume it's in his coffin that he was in earlier. But I also do just picture a loose corpse
he's in his coffin. So the procession marched across the bridge to Fort Western. And, which I think was a town? I don't know. And eventually got to the Mount Vernon Cemetery, which also at some point was the Burnt Hill Cemetery, but also the Mount Hope Cemetery.
It's had a few names.
Yeah. So where the bodies of Elizabeth and her six children were buried side by side in the northeast corner in unmarked graves. And I don't know why they did that, because every other, like, family massacre that I've done, they have, like, a giant
like
stone,
a big memorial thing.
James's body with the axe and straight razor were buried between the roadside and the cemetery, but there was a rumor that he was secretly exhumed the following night for science done by, Bowdoin College. Don't know how to say that name, but
them burying him between the road and the cemetery is why every time someone in my job is like, but we're doing it next to the cemetery. And I was like, yeah, so all of the criminals and paupers are going to be right outside the fence.
Or people that killed themselves. Because that was another thing, is he wasn't buried in because he was a felon, but also because he killed himself. And you're not allowed to
cemeteries
be buried.
Go at least 10 feet outside of
the
cemetery fence.
Well, you weren't back then allowed to be buried within cemeteries if you killed yourself. Because they're religious places, and that's a sin, a major one. Anyway. But I know some people don't know that. Martha ended up dying of her wounds on July 30th, so she lived about... 20-something days.
Oh, that'd suck, because they don't even have, like, modern pain medication.
And a pamphlet found, so just like your story, how it got published, like, right away, everything got published right away for this one, too, so that's why everything's so well-known about this one. So, in a pamphlet found from the time of the crimes, there was more information on some things. The general opinion that the jury of inquest had was that James was, quote, seized with an attack of hereditary insanity, and was a manic when he committed the deed. The writer of the pamphlet also shared their personal views on religion and the lessons taught by the tragedy, which filled up most of the 22 pages of this pamphlet.
Oh my gosh.
So the Purrington family massacre is also mentioned in A Midwife's Tale, which is based on the diary of Martha Ballard. Mm-hmm. Martha, the daughter, not the other Martha, mm-hmm. was cared for by Jonas Ballard. He was Martha Ballard's son. So she had, like, heard the stories from, mm-hmm. Anyway, so over the following weeks, when Martha remained alive, she recounted the night her dad killed her family. Martha shared a room with Polly, who had told Martha about the letter that he had written, the suicide note. And that night, Martha woke up to Polly's screams and hid. She shielded her head and was hit with the axe several times. Her skull had been fractured and was extremely wounded, but she kept quiet in order to try and stay alive, because she was like, I was in so much pain, but, like, mm-hmm. I just kept biting back every noise I was trying to make to stay alive, so he thought I'd be dead.
Yeah.
The attacker left the room, and she heard the rest of her family being murdered. She didn't know that the person who had attacked her was her father until several days later. Isn't that even worse?
Yeah.
Because she didn't look to see who was in the room. She heard Polly screaming, hid, covered her head.
At this point, she thinks all of her family, she knows her brother's alive and that is it. Everyone else is dead. And then later to be told, oh, wait, it's your dad who did this to everybody.
Yeah. So a few days after the murders, a one-page publication was put out entitled, Horrid Murder! Exclamation point. And had 7 coffins pictured on it. Why did I say coffins like that? This publication was printed all over the U.S. and all over the world. You can find this on loc.gov and read the actual print. And it's actually
it's like the Library of Congress.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's the actual scan, so you could actually zoom all the way in and, like, read everything it says. So there was supposedly another letter that James had wrote that was found in the home or with some relative after the murders, where he rambled about his religious views and said he hoped for future happiness for all of his family.
Yeah, he had some mental health issues. Yeah.
So 2 months after the murders, there was another print that said there were 3 sources that could cause someone to do this to their family, other than not being sound of mind. Religious fanaticism, violence of passion, or systematic calculation upon erroneous principles. Those are the other 3 things that it could be. So
he's not wrong. Those are like those are
reasons. It was some church guy that said that, I think.
Especially the erroneous principles one. There's a lot of murders that are.
He was known to quote believe in universal salvation. This is James the. Is it James? Yeah.
James the dad. This is James and James.
I was going to say Jonas, but there was a Jonas. That's not them. Okay, so anyway. So he was known to, quote, believe in universal salvation. His manners were reserved, and he was obstinately,
yep.
I can't read, tenacious of his opinion. The publication says that, quote, his whole conduct the day preceding and during the last and bloody scene of his life seems marked with the utmost coolness and deliberation. James did not possess a fiery passion. He was industrious and headstrong, but not prone to use violence in the face of his obstacles. That only leaves option 3. The sinner, while his principles are correct, is like a lion chained, comparatively harmless, but when his principles are perverted, he commits iniquity, not only without remorse, but with greediness.
And that's what the guy who wrote the 3 reasons why.
Yeah.
And then he's describing this situation. Yes.
So a lot of people thought the reason he killed his family had something to do with his religion. His letter to his brother talks about him not wanting to fail his family and him wanting to end his own life. He eventually decided to take all of them with him so they can be with him, eternally happy. There were rumors that he would talk about the afterlife, and he was often heard when he was surrounded by his family, like if they were all out together somewhere, mm-hmm. that he would talk about his anticipation for when they could all be eternally happy, and he would often say how happy he would be if they could all die together at once.
So there were a whole bunch of things that said this could be a possibility.
So before James went to bed that night, before James went to bed the night before the murders, James Jr.,
mm-hmm.
he saw his father reading the Bible, and the next morning, the Bible was found open to chapter 9 of Ezekiel, and on the pages, there's a passage that says, quote, go through the city and strike. Do not let your eye have pity, and do not spare. Utterly slay old men, young men, little children, and women.
Oh, gosh.
And this is why I don't read the Bible. I think it's a terrible... like, that's messed up. Anyway, so the only surviving family member, James Jr., went on to live with neighbors and eventually died 8 years later due to disease. So that's really sad that he didn't even get to live a long, full life. Elizabeth and her children's graves were forgotten until because unmarked. Because
they didn't mark it.
Until 2006, which was the 200th anniversary of their murders, when archaeologists located their bodies in Mount Hope Cemetery and the city installed a headstone. So now they have a big old headstone like everybody else. There are rumors that the axe that James used to kill his family with was dug up by a man who was using a metal detector near where James is said to have been buried. And that the man, like, dug it up and was like, oh, look at this nice axe. And then took it in and got it dated. And it did date back to the time that the murders happened. But it's never been proven that this was the murder weapon or it's true.
How could you... I have questions about that, because this is not that long ago, and axes don't change that much.
I don't know. So anyway, I mean, I say that James, like, obviously had some major mental issues, but it was also just, like, another, like, you know, family annihilator savior complex, where he's like, I can't let down my family, so I'm going to kill everybody.
Yep. Or even if it was because he thought they'd be happier in heaven, he wanted them to get there as quickly as possible.
And... I think that, you know, reading that last page is what really put him over the edge, is that he believed, like, what he was thinking was the Bible justifying him killing his whole family, so he thought killing all of them would be better than him just killing himself, but...
Because they could be all happy together.
It's real messed up. If you think that bringing your whole family with you is better for them, I'm telling you right now it's not. Let's stop family annihilators, because men are the worst. Well, because, like, whatever I feel like... I think
one of the problems is the doomsday cult that certain sects of Christianity are. The idea that you'll be so much more happy in heaven, so we just gotta get there ASAP, is concerning.
You know, if God put you on this planet, then what's, like, I don't get it. Why would he put you on this planet if you're supposed to get to heaven as soon as possible? Yeah,
if he didn't want you to experience it here.
You know... People don't think logically is what I just don't get, but... And I want to know, like, what's wrong with men that they're the family annihilators? Because, like, women, if they, like, kill their family, I feel like they never kill the husband.
They usually just do the kids and, like, some weird postpartum depression thing and they kill their kids,
yeah. So what's with men? It's just because men think they have to do everything for their family and, like...
I mean, it's, the patriarchy is poisonous, so...
Yeah. Anyway, don't become a family annihilator. And try not to kill anybody and done with Ouija boards. Bye.